Stay tuned now for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores.
Come to the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. In beautiful Hyde Park, 57th Street Books, at 1301 East 57th Street, is where serious readers go for fun. Enjoy a wide selection of titles in a unique space that's perfect for browsing. Specialties include literature, mysteries, children's books, cookbooks, and travel. The Newberry Library Bookstore at 60 West Walton carries a distinctive selection of books, cards, and gifts in a beautiful landmark setting. Specialties include Native American studies, history, genealogy, cartography, calligraphy, and music. And the Seminary Co-op at 5757 South University Avenue, across from the University of Chicago Quad, enjoys a reputation as one of the best academic bookstores anywhere. Known for the breadth and depth of its inventory, the co-op carries more than 100,000 titles in a wide range of disciplines. Visit the Seminary Co-op bookstores in person. Call toll-free 800-777-1456 or look up semcoop.com.
Victoria Lautman's guest today is Andrea Barrett, whose book, The Air We Breathe, will be the topic of discussion. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us here at Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman. We are very happy to have an incredible lineup for this fourth season of the series, and I will be giving some dates. We have Ann Packer coming up. We have Michael Lowenthal, we have Richard Price, and we've just got a great, Russell Banks, great season coming up. We're very happy that all of you in the audience have helped make this such a tremendous success. We will be taking questions in the later part of this hour. But right now, what I'd like to do is introduce my guest, Andrea Barrett, because for the past 10 years, she has really been our go-to writer for stories melding 19th century history, exploration, and pretty intense emotions. Where else would you be able to find somebody to write so convincingly about a Himalayan mapping expedition and its effect on a marriage, mainly through the letters written by one of the explorers? That's from Servants of the Map, which came out in 2002, and which also, by the way, earned Barrett a Pulitzer nomination. In The Voyage of the Narwhal from 1998, Barrett synthesized well over 30 diaries and reports of actual Arctic journeys to create her own fictional one. And who else would be so thorough, so compulsive in their research as to present that kind of information to us in such a compelling way? In Ship Fever, which was her collection of stories from 1996, that nabbed her the National Book Award, we were all plunged into the misery of Irish immigrants mired in a typhoid epidemic in the story called Ship Fever. In 2001, Barrett was awarded the MacArthur Prize, and it's really kind of fascinating to know that she tried pretty hard to be a scientist first, studying biology and zoology before giving it up for a career in writing. Her new book is The Air We Breathe. It revisits one of Barrett's favorite topics, infectious disease, in this case, tuberculosis. She never ceases to be compelled by that and mines it for new things. It is my great pleasure to welcome Andrea Barrett. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Your fans.
Well, thank you. That's really the sweetest thing ever.
You know, it's interesting. I think people are so focused on the work that you've done in 19th century stories and exploration and science that most people don't realize you actually wrote four novels starting in 1988.
Yeah.
But they didn't quite place you in the public eye as the 19th century. Does that hurt your feelings?
No, but it's funny. People very often introduce me as someone who has written four books rather than eight books. The first four books just drop off the map entirely. You're kind to say that they didn't quite place me in the public eye. The truth is they sold each of them, I think, rather less than 2,000 copies. They disappeared without a trace.
No, you can now get them, though. They've reissued them.
You can now get them in reprints. I still like them. They're what I learned to write on. Everything I know about making characters, about setting characters in situations where they can act on each other came from those early books. And it wasn't until I had done four of them that I thought, well, maybe now I know enough about constructing a story that I can use some of my skills to approach material from history that I'm really deeply interested in. I don't think I could have started just writing about history. I had to know how to make a book, how to make a character.
Well, and I think because I didn't go into all of your background, but you tell everybody you were a high school dropout with the caveat that in junior year when you left high school out of boredom, you then decided to apply to college and got in. And your career in writing didn't even become something that you were serious about until you were in your 30s. You went and got your BA in biology, then you studied zoology, then you thought, no, this isn't right. Then you took a detour into medieval history, and it was, you have told people about the moment, this kind of aha moment, when you were writing about the Inquisition and giving these great dialogues to, I don't know, these torturers, and decided, wait, I could make a story about this.
Yeah, it was a real surprise to me. I thought I was doing biology when I was doing biology, and it turns out I wasn't. I was reading about biology. Those are very different enterprises. I love stories about old scientists. I love stories about how people investigate the natural world, about how they become obsessive about one aspect of the natural world. You cannot actually be a scientist with only that trait and no other traits. So I turned to history, and the same thing happened to me there. Real history is about research and uncovering things that no one has uncovered before. There is a storytelling component of it, and I really wanted to skip all the research and get right to the storytelling component. And I think it's that moment that made me realize, if I like stories about scientists and I like stories about history and I don't like doing actual laboratory work, maybe there's a common thread here.
Well, it's funny that this book, although we would think of it as historical because the air we breathe is set in a tuberculosis sanitarium in 1916, mm-hmm. In the Adirondacks. Now, to us, that seems very historical, but to you, even that sort of catapulted you into a whole new era that you hadn't really explored for a long time. That must have been, it's a decision that you must have really thought about at great length. Do you want to go into the 20th century?
It was a big leap for me. I know that sounds funny. It was like, oh my God, there's cars. What am I going to do? There's cars, there's telephones, there's airplanes. It really is a different world. I'm very at home in late 19th century material and mid-19th century material, but that turning point into the technology of the early 20th century, I think that's one of the reasons it took me so long to write the book. I had to not only write the book and do the research for the book, but get conversant with the period and make it natural to me in the same way that Victorian times were already natural to me. It was a lot to learn, but very fun, too.
You had written about TB before, mm-hmm. and in fact, people who have read your books starting from Ship Fever will recognize characters. I mean, you in one of the stories in Ship Fever, I think that's which one it was in, we actually meet the granddaughters of one of the major characters.
That's right.
In this book, Leo Marburg. So there's and you actually have a kind of a family tree in a way at the end of this book for the first time, linking all these characters for 300 years or so.
Yeah.
I'm interested in your decision to continue to pursue the topic of tuberculosis, which you had explored in The Cure before.
Yeah, I think for some people it was like enough already with the TB, but I was very interested, not just with the disease and how it's communicated, but with the social situation that comes with it. In The Cure, I was writing about people in private boarding cottages, people with some means who would go to these houses and be taken care of, well taken care of. in groups of 10 or 12 people. While I was researching that, though, I started to see these big public sanatoria, usually away from the villages, tucked in the woods. And I started to get very curious about what it would be like to be confined in a place that, in some ways, they mimic prisons. And in fact, after the 1940s, when an antibiotic was discovered that is usually effective against tuberculosis and the sanatoria emptied out, many of those buildings became prisons, or they became nursing homes. They became something else that's kind of scary and institutional. So it was that idea of people confined in these big buildings. They often didn't have a choice as to whether to go there. They never had any money. By definition, those were charity institutions. They were funded by taxpayers. And it's always intriguing for a novelist to get a group of people confined in a single place that they can't leave under pressure, whether they're on a ship or a prison or in a sanatorium. There's always something there about how people will interact that's really very compelling.
Well, I would like you to read from the very start of this book when we first meet the narrator, who actually is the whole group of people. We'll have to explore that a little bit later on. And it sort of sets up what this sanitarium was like. So, Andrea Barrett, if you would.
Sure. Imagine a hill shaped like a dog's head, its nose pointed south and resting on crossed front paws. The main buildings of Tamarack State Sanatorium for the treatment of tuberculosis, including the two long brick wings where we used to cure, are set where the eyes would be. There's a siding at the base of the hill, four posts, a metal roof, space for a cart and the portable steps, where the train makes a special stop and where, on arrival day, we'd each looked up to see the sanatorium windows staring back at us. We all remember looking down for the first time, after getting settled in one of those wings, to see the new arrivals sagging down the steps or being passed on stretchers through the windows of the train. Back then, we lay on our porches in orderly rows, the two chairs assigned to each room, still separated by shoulder-high panels and sheltered by canvas awnings. Fields surrounded us, they still do, and also a river, three ponds, and the road curving down toward the village. After the cities from which we'd come, this looked to us like wilderness. Rivers, mountains, wild geese honking. The air meant to cure us, pouring antiseptically through the woods. The Adirondacks were new to us, and we were shocked to learn that Canada was so near. The snow shocked us too, along with the dark winter days and the heavy mist that sometimes blanketed the fields. A fox, hunting, would brush his tail through the surface, leaving a track we followed with our eyes. Ducks escaping the fox would burst into the air as if they'd been shot. The sight made us think that our own lives, hidden similarly, might still be launched on their proper paths. We weren't a big group even then. 60 women and 60 men, if every spot was taken. And a single arrival shifted scores of relationships, as did a single discharge or a death. On the porches, we gossiped as eagerly as we drew breath. Twice each week, if the mist didn't block our view, the train pulled up to our unmarked siding, and we inspected who might join us next. In late July of 1916, the train from New York City brought us Leo Marburg. Tall, thin, with black hair worn too long and big hands with spatulate fingertips, he paused on the boarding steps until a porter passed him like a sack of wheat to the driver of our cart. The driver, without asking, draped Leo over the pallet in the back. Leo forced himself back up. "I'm not that sick," he said. Up on the hill, our windows blinked at him. "Let me sit beside you." He eased himself down and around until, with the driver's grudging help, he was on the bench and looking out over the horses. The cart climbed from the siding and up the track, the buildings dotting the lower slope, wavering slightly in the suffocating haze. Staff cottages, laundry, incinerator, power plant. He recognized only the stables, the others he'd learn later. The mountains were cool, he'd been told in the city, the air crisp and restorative. So what was this steamy batting wrapped around him? Inside the door of our central building, Leo found it hotter still. The linoleum floor felt sticky. The hands of the nurse to whom the driver delivered him were hot and moist, and she treated him, Leo thought, like a bag of raw sugar being taken off a ship. Plop into a wheelchair, plop when his carpet bag into his lap, plop on top of the carpet bag when a pamphlet bound in olive paper. Rule book, this said helpfully. Read it, said the nurse.
Andrea Barrett. Reading from her new book, The Air We Breathe. The rule book is not only hard to imagine because it's treating these group of 60 women and 60 men, these adults, as children, basically, and everything is so regimented. But it also, I mean, it does really point out that these people's lives weren't their own anymore. They, as you mentioned, they were pretty much forcibly taken to these places, which were, I'm not even sure quite what the difference is between them and prison. They were, every aspect of their daily lives was pretty much dictated to them. They had a period of 2 hours a day, that a day that was up to them to do with what they wanted. They were separated, the men and the women. They could only interact very infrequently. Mm-hmm. And you start the book with a quote from an actual pamphlet, a nursing pamphlet from 1915, that talks about how TB was a disease of the poverty-stricken, both morally and financially. And so these people were made to feel from the get-go, and part of the rule book and part of what they had to read was something about how basically you're lucky to be here. You're lucky we're taking care of you.
Yeah, I mean, that's ostensibly the big difference between a sanatorium and a prison. It is that you're not being punished, theoretically. You're being cared for. You're being given a chance to cure this disease. But the best you can say, really, is that people were treated as children. The regimen was so strict then. And there's so much stigma then and still now attached to having tuberculosis. One of the really interesting things about working on this book, I don't think I ever heard anyone mention tuberculosis to me my whole life until I started working with this material. Once I started working with it, someone will say, "What are you writing?" I'll say, "Oh, I'm writing a novel about tuberculosis." Almost without exception, a person will say to me then, "Oh, my mother had tuberculosis, my grandmother had tuberculosis, I had a cousin in a sanatorium, I had an uncle who worked in a sanatorium." But those stories still don't get told commonly among us, and that's because there was such social stigma attached to having tuberculosis in the early 20th century. And that in turn is because the disease was so often presented, although it is not, but it was presented as a disease of poor people, of immigrants, of people who lived in crowded conditions and didn't have good hygiene. So, of course, everyone got tuberculosis. Anyone can, and everyone did. But wealthier people, because of the associations with poverty and with immigrants, they were apt not to talk about it if there was tuberculosis in their family because they thought it signaled to people, oh, your family is lower class or working class in some way. And that whole aspect of class became very interesting to me.
Well, and I think to say that this is a book about TB is not to really give it its full due. It's a book that uses that as a jumping off place for a whole bunch of things, including, I mean, Leo Marburg we've met, but there are three other people who form the corners of what can only be described as a love quadrangle, with everybody kind of being interested in somebody else and everybody getting the information wrong all the way along pretty much. And you explain the hierarchies, not just in society and between rich people and poor people, but the hierarchy of a town devoted to sick people, people who are the caregivers and people who are the ones who are the recipients of it. And I think some of the most interesting moments of the book are when those two things clash.
Oh, I'm glad. That's a really important moment for me that One of the central characters you're speaking of is a woman named Eudora McEachern, and she works as a ward maid inside the hospital. She's actually also related to characters in earlier books. The two women in The Cure are distant and older relatives of hers. So she has that model before her of working in a place, taking care of people with tuberculosis, not being afraid to do that. But for everybody else in the town, as in any resort town, there's always a kind of split between the people who are making money from those who come to town, whether as a resort or to cure from tuberculosis, and the people who are spending money in the town and are trying to recover in the town. Those people who are new to the town are both desired because of the income they bring, and sometimes they're despised because they're not from that area. In this case, they're also sick. In this case, they're also from an urban area, and this is in a very rural place. So there's a lot of mixed feeling, a sense of wanting those people there and also not wanting those people there.
As in all of your books, it's very clear to readers that when something gets your writerly attention, and that becomes one of the things that we really end up knowing a lot about, not just TB in this case, but specifically in this book, the idea of x-rays. One of the great characters in the book, a sort of tangential character, not part of the love quadrangle, but one who sort of facilitates it, is Irene from Krakow, who is there and is kind of occupying an interesting position between mm-hmm. the ill people and the caregivers. She's a very independent woman. At a time when only men were involved really in science, she learns about x-rays in its very early stages. And she's fascinating not just because of the role she plays, but because there's something also just frightening about her. She wears a lavender glove because it turns out she has had to continually amputate parts of her body because of these early x-rays. This obviously really resonated with you.
Yeah, in all sorts of ways. She is based on a great many other people. Her situation was actually not uncommon at all. X-rays began to be used for medical reasons very soon after they were discovered, but they were perceived then as utterly benign, health-giving, life-giving. We could see inside someone's body. We could see where a shell in a war had landed in someone's leg. We could see the tuberculosis in someone's chest. No one had an idea for the longest time that they had a detrimental effect on us as well. So it was very common. The early x-ray tubes were beautiful hand-blown spheres of glass with little bits of wire inside. And what people did was to adjust the voltage with one hand and to hold their other hand right in front of the tube to see if the picture was coming across clearly. If you're right-handed, it was your left hand you held in front of the tube. So virtually everyone who experimented with x-rays in the early years lost parts of their hand, then their whole hand, then their hand up to the elbow, then the shoulder, then you can see where this is going. The stories are very grim. There's it's actually such a terrible joke, I'm not going to tell it.
afterwards.
there are a lot of stories about people suffering from the ill effects of x-rays during the 20s and 30s after having spent 10 or 20 years working with them. So in Irene, I tried to embody a lot of that. I'm also really interested in the literary metaphor of seeing through, trying to see more deeply, and that, of course, is what x-rays embody. Also, metaphorically, we always think, well, if we could really see into someone, or we could see what they were thinking, or we could see their hearts, it would be better for us. We would understand more. And that doesn't always work out so well either. So that's part of what the x-rays are doing at the center of the book. A lot of the book is about trying to see into and through each other, mis-seeing each other, being blind in certain ways. It's no coincidence that there are four people who are all in love with the wrong person, all seeing each other in incorrect ways. And so for me, that's all tied together.
It's probably the only time I can remember in any literary setting where an x-ray ends up being kind of an erotic thing.
Yeah, that's the steamy scene in the novel, is someone looking inside someone else's chest.
So. It's not what you... It's been a have a whole new light on the next time we go to the doctor once That's a right. month or once a year. But
it's not as neutral as you think.
No, and in this case, because of the timing when it's set, the idea that well, you never really think of an X-ray as being that intimate. It's something mm-hmm. that we're completely, you know, used to. But Leo Marburg and Eudora, who's taking the X-ray, in those years, it was still, you know, it was so early. And the idea that somebody else could be right. looking inside your body, I mean, it's as sexy a thing as you could possibly get.
You know, it was so sexy. People used to write then, there were columns in the newspapers and the magazines about how X-rays were sinful, that they allowed us to see the shape of a woman's body beneath her clothing, that they were going to lead to all sorts of deviant behavior. And there were advertisements for clothing that were supposed to block X-rays, so that if you were walking down a street and someone happened to have an X-ray tube, which you could buy an X-ray tube just by ordering it from anybody. There were ads in the back of Scientific American. You could buy a tube and buy a transformer, and you could set up in your basement, and people did. There were a lot of amateur X-ray photographers, just like there's photographers, and a corresponding amount of worry about the terrible erotic taint of being able to see like this. It was amazing.
Put on those lead underpants, I guess.
They really did have the lead.
Now, did you know when you were writing the book, was that fascination with X-rays? I know your husband is a X-ray crystallographer mm-hmm. or something, too, so you were already acquainted with it. But did this sort of pique your interest in another way? I know you're also working on something further with X-rays now.
Yeah, I've always been interested in X-rays because of the work that my husband does, but I didn't know it was going to assume such a large role in the book. The more I looked into the early history of it, I really just wanted to have a woman who was using an X-ray tube there, but it just grew over time because it is so interesting. The equipment itself is interesting, and also our response to it is very different. We not only have X-rays, we have CAT scanners and PET scanners, and we are apt to think when we go in for an X-ray that it's a completely clear-cut procedure. We go in and these marvelous machines make these incredibly crisp images, and a doctor looks at the image and says, oh, there's a tumor or there's something wrong with your bone there. In fact, these images are not completely easy to read even now, and they were the reverse of easy to read in the early days. An X-ray image to an untrained eye in 1916 and 1917, it essentially meant nothing. It was so vague, it was so blurry, things were so confused. It took an incredibly trained eye and a lot of almost artistic insight to get from those shadows and that vagueness what actually might have been causing it, and that's what really interested me about that too.
Well, the other part about this book, which takes it away from just the domain of infectious disease and illness, is that it's set right on the eve of America's involvement in World War I, 1916. And so we watch this community go from just an isolated, nothing cure community out in the Adirondacks to being a very frightening kind of microcosm of what was going on in a lot of parts of the country at that time. And that the people who seemed terribly benign at the start of the book, whether they were in the sanatorium or were in the cure cottages for the wealthier people, suddenly become divided and separated because of what's going on, you know, thousands of miles away.
That's right. That the incursion of the war into them, I suppose in some ways reflects the way the book was written for me. I started writing the novel thinking I would just write a novel that was set in a sanatorium and the war would stay outside it. And that was very naive of me, really, to think that I could write a novel set in 1916 and 1917 and not have the war play a role. But, you know, the war was on the other side of the ocean, the people were in the Adirondacks in a sanatorium. I thought that they would not engage with it very much. And inevitably, they do, as I had to do. You can't stay isolated from a war, no matter how far away you are from it, especially not in a public institution. Newspapers come in, people come in, visitors come in, and then more painfully, every decision about how a public institution is run is affected by politics. Politics are affected by the war. There were people who resented very much the money spent on taking care of people in these institutions because they wanted to make ammunition with it.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll find out about how the book was affected by a much more current war and how these two affected one another. But you've been listening to Andrea Barrett. We're talking about her new book, The Air We Breathe. This is Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Don't go away.
You're tuned to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and WFMT.com, and you're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who've published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. In 1961, Seminary Co-op Bookstore was founded by 17 book lovers who invested $10 each. Now, this consumer-owned bookstore is three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue carries about 200,000 titles and is widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a neighborhood bookstore carrying a wide selection of general interest titles in a unique space, perfect for browsing. And the Newberry Library's Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in genealogy, cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more in a beautiful landmark setting. The Seminary Co-op Bookstore's passion and experience have appealed to readers throughout the world. All their branches offer 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, as well as special author events. Visit the Seminary Co-op Bookstores today. Call 800-777-1456 toll-free or look up semcoop.com. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place Sundays at noon at Looking Glass Theater. On our next broadcast of Writers on the Record, Victoria Lautman talks with Ann Packer about her book, Songs Without Words. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman has been discussing the book, The Air We Breathe, with its author, Andrea Barrett.
With Victoria Lautman, I'm talking to Andrea Barrett about her new book, The Air We Breathe. But, of course, she won the National Book Award for Ship Fever in 1996. Her Voyage of the Narwhal from 1998 was a tremendous novel. Servants of the Map came out in 2002, and that was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And there are four other earlier novels that everybody should go back and read now: Lucid Stars, Secret Harmonies, The Middle Kingdom, and The Forms of Water. I also want to take this opportunity, since I have your undivided attention, to mention that next month, November 11th, Ann Packer will be here to talk about her new book, Songs Without Words. We have no broadcast in December, but we'll be back in January with Michael Lowenthal, followed by Russell Banks, then Richard Price, and Elizabeth Strout. But we are now in 1916 in a sanatorium at Tamarack Lake. Americans have entered the war, and Miles Fairchild, who is one of the rich guys staying in one of the cure cottages, who has formed a crush on a much younger woman, one of the non-sick, and his driver, Naomi, he has started this book deciding to sort of get more involved with the poverty-stricken, largely immigrant community at the sanatorium right up the hill. And he's decided to have an education night once a week where everybody who wants to gets together and talks about things. And this becomes the catalyst for a lot of what subsequently happens in the book. For the first time, these men and women who don't really get to interact much anyway begin to see each other as actual individuals as opposed to merely sick people. And at one point, this group narrator talks about how for the first time they felt nearly whole. But also by breaking down those barriers, it only served to, I think, show later on when Miles becomes this very officious, dangerous character in the community to root out spies and people who are kind of anti-American. Suddenly everybody is thrown into turmoil. They've almost found these ties too close to one another.
Yeah, I think when the patients first start going to the group, they're just going so they can see each other. They're going really so the men and the women can be together. They don't have very many chances to do that. They're not interested in Miles, who sort of drones on about paleontology. And Miles, in turn, he says it's a self-education group, but I think he really has the idea that he will lead it constantly and that he will do most of the talking and everyone else will listen. So he is surprised, and I think the patients are surprised themselves, when they sort of take over the group. There's a moment in the book where when Miles first starts talking to them, he's standing in front of them. They're all arranged before him in nice, sturdy little rows of chairs. And after a few meetings, one of the patients says, "Let's put our chairs in a circle the way we used to do in our workman's circle when we were in New York." And from that moment on, the group is not an autocrat dictating down to a group of supplicant listeners, but a democracy. It's one person in the circle standing up one day, one person standing up another day. They really do meet as equals, and they begin to share things as equals. And that's something that I think Miles finds quite disagreeable, although he doesn't know how to stop it.
Well, a little while later on, a cataclysm occurs at the sanatorium. And as a result of that, some people die. And suddenly, the suspicions, which are breaking out all over the country at that point against immigrants and where issues of class really are thrown into the forefront, and not just class really, more like the other, people who are not mm-hmm. us, suddenly rise to the forefront. I want you to read from later in the book where there's just a chapter that has a couple of obituaries of some of the people at Tamarack State, and then we'll talk about how these made it into the book.
Okay. Yes, it's just a very short chapter. It's really just a list. Later, when such things became possible, we placed these notices in our Kilgloom Gazette. Edith Weinstein, born 1881 in Brooklyn, New York, daughter of Israel and Ida Weinstein, stepdaughter of Helen Graber Weinstein first and Louise Rubin Weinstein second, beloved sister of Helena, Samuel, Louis, Udala, Esther, Lika, David, and Gabriel. First employed at age 14 as a buttonhole maker, Edith continued work in the garment industry until 1913, when she was diagnosed with tuberculosis. After a short stay at Bellevue Hospital and a period living in a roof tent, she arrived at Tamarack State in March of 1915. An avid moving picture fan, her reviews in the Kilgloom Gazette were much appreciated by those too ill to attend movie nights. She entered the infirmary only a week before the fire, after the onset of intractable intestinal symptoms, and on the night of her death had delegated two assistants to take notes, as she was unable to attend herself. Her skill with a needle was legendary, and many of us benefited from the alterations she made without charge to our clothes. Among her many friends here, she is particularly missed by Hazel, Rosica, and Bell. Morris Viola, born 1896 in Utica, New York, only son of Sadie and Joseph Viola. In high school, Morris was notable as a champion debater, two-time winner of the Central New York Spelling Bee, an outstanding thespian, best remembered for his role as Brutus during his senior year. After graduating from high school in 1914, he enrolled at Cornell University but was taken ill before the end of his first semester. His father, having suffered an accident at the slaughterhouse that year, and his mother much occupied in caring for his father, he was sent to Tamarack State in February of 1915. Released in April of 1916, he was sent back in July after a relapse. From November of that year until his death, he was confined to the infirmary. Not well known among us generally, he was a particular favorite of Dr. Petrie's. We don't have funerals here. When we die, our bodies are taken away at night to the village for an autopsy or directly to the undertakers, returned either way in a plain pine box and buried quietly. The cemetery is a mile north of our central buildings, in a clearing on the other side of the hill, hidden by a border of white pines, never shown to visitors, and not mentioned in our rule book. We learn where it is from each other. When, during an afternoon walk, one person shows another the clearing for the first time, it usually signals a new stage in the relationship. After that, we think differently about how long we've been here and what time we might have left. Twice since the fire, all of us involved in the Wednesday gatherings have gone to the clearing as a group to visit the three who, although they didn't join in those afternoons, were still tied to us. The hospital commission gives us modest grave markers rather than headstones, low oblongs 12 by 4 inches, set almost flush with the ground. Morris, Edith, and Dennis lie at the western edge of an area about the size of a swimming pool, neatly paved.
One thing I wanted to ask you about this is this kind of brave decision you made to have a narrator who is a group. It's almost like a Greek chorus, but with more detail. Mm-hmm. What prompted that decision, and who is this? Is this really a group in your mind, or is one voice coming out to you?
It really is a group in my mind. Some people have said to me they read the book waiting for some one person to separate out from the group. And as you'll see when you get to the end, no one person does, and there's a reason for that. For me, the group is not all the patients. It is the group of people who are involved in the Wednesday gatherings. And the book always came to me in this voice. I wish it had been a decision, because I probably would have decided otherwise. It was a difficult voice to write in, and it ended up taking a long time for me to understand it. But the book really wanted to be in this voice and no other. Every other person who could have told it singly was a single person by definition. Every other point of view was a singular point of view by definition. And to me, the essence of this book is really that struggle between the community and the individual, between our desire to be part of a group, and not just part of a group, but on the inside of a group, comfortably nested in the center, and our desires to be free and solitary and obdurate and not part of our group. We're always wavering in that in our real lives. And these people are more than wavering. They're actually suspended in that tension between group and individual. So I really wanted to find a voice that not only talked about that, but embodied that, if possible.
If anybody's interested in asking questions, this is a good time to start making your way to the microphones. Well, the other thing about that particular chapter with those three obituaries, when I read it, I immediately thought of the New York Times obituaries that were published of every person who they identified that died in the World Trade Center attacks on September 11th. And it was only after then reading the book and thinking about that, and also there's many other parallels, obvious ones. There's a point where the mayor of the town has a dachshund, and he decides not to call it anymore by its German name, but calls it a Liberty Pup. And, you know, I thought immediately of Liberty Fries and Freedom Fries, rather. And this book really, as you say very clearly in an essay you wrote called The Sea of Information, was profoundly changed by being in New York on September 10th.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to get a fellowship to go to New York for a year and research this book. My character started in New York. I didn't know the city well. I wanted to live there and investigate. So I moved to Brooklyn in June of 2001 and was meant to take up this fellowship at the New York Public Library on September 10th. We went in that day to have our pictures taken, but our first real day of work was September 11th. So I got up that morning to bring my dog to the dog sitter and get in the subway, and I heard a big noise, and that was the first plane hitting the tower. So the whole year was, of course, completely shaped by that. And the book very much changed, not really by the immediate aftermath of September 11th, but by some months after that, as the climate of the city and as the climate of the country began to darken so swiftly and so strongly, I started to read a lot about the analogous time during World War I. Liberty pup is actually a real phrase. Everything in this country that had a German name during 1916 and 17, even things like sauerkraut, they were either renamed or they were removed from menus. Any allusion to Germany, to German science, to German food, to German culture, and this in a country that had a huge number, I mean, a great many of us have German ancestors. It was a very large emigration. A great many universities had German professors. We as a country were very interested in German culture and German music. That's a big part of our heritage. And all of a sudden during that year, just nothing that had a German background could be talked about in any way. Someone actually said I shouldn't use Liberty Pups in the novel because it was so well known, but our cultural history is very short. I think a lot of us forget it. And that reaction against what we can pin down as being the other, the suddenness and sharpness of that reaction, that's what really struck me as so much in common with the years immediately following September 11th, that need to seize on somebody who can be pushed aside, pushed out, called the other, and to pin our fears and our despair on that. That's part of history. It comes up again and again.
Where would this book have gone if not for being in New York at that time? Do you have any idea? Would it have been terribly different, do you think?
You know, I can't really know that. It might be that any book that had these characters confined in a situation confronting the war, they might inevitably have begun to talk about it and something might inevitably have begun between them. But I don't think it would have had such an emphasis on the American Protective League, on the suspicion about spies and saboteurs as it ultimately came to have.
We have a couple questions here, please.
Well, thank you, Victoria Lautman, for hosting this session and for everything you do to bring culture to Chicago.
Well, you're welcome.
And thank you, Andrea Barrett, for your amazing works of fiction.
Thank you.
My question is about...
Let go of that.
Oh, let go. Right.
There you go.
My question is about the connections in your books from novel to novel or story to story in which different characters reappear. I found that fascinating. And when I read Servants of the Map, I was taking notes, and by the end there were so many lines drawn from one character to the other, and what I remembered about the stories in Ship Fever. I even attempted to sketch out a family tree, and I'm glad to hear that you have gifted us with one at the end of your new book. But I'd love to hear you talk about what is gained by doing that, what the connections bring to you as a writer, to what extent you've thought about them all before and have them charted out, or if they come to you as you write, and why you develop them in that way rather than starting with a whole new group of characters.
Great question.
Yeah, that is. Thank you for that. It's not really voluntary. I don't chart them out beforehand. It's not as if I thought, oh, I have this great set of a gazillion characters and I'll write a bunch of books that will take care of them all. They grow and evolve very naturally as I write. I do have a family tree like the one you made. It's in my study. It's a great big sheet of construction paper with little teeny tiny writing in pencil all over it and all these lines and erasures. I think the reason I keep doing it is maybe simply that the world is completely connected for me. That's how I see the world. And sometimes when I read a novel I really love or a set of stories I really love, I'm so sad at the end of it to close the book and not only have the story come to an end, but to have those people just leave the universe. When I'm writing a story or a novel, the story ends, but the people stay alive. They just go off stage. I still know where they are. They're still leading their lives. And it is some need in me, I think, that wants to go back and pick them up and see what they're doing now and see what their children are doing and see what their neighbors are doing. For readers, I hope that it gives a sense of enlarging the space around the book. If you read a book and it rounds off at the end, but you know you can pick up something else and find out a little bit more of the story. That in some ways is the way we experience our lives. We know a friend, and the friend maybe goes out of our life for 10 years, and then we see the friend again, and it's as if we were never parted. We catch up on their stories. And so I like to bring that feel to a fictional world, too.
My question is a little more factual, and I know that this is a novel. What were the statistics of cure, and did the patients know their outcome in tuberculosis in prior to World War I? I think it would be a little more easier to understand them emotionally if we knew about the disease a little more factually.
Yeah. I don't actually know the statistics. There may be someone in the audience who's a doctor who does. People did know the outcome in the rough sense, which is the outcome wasn't good. Tuberculosis was not treatable with a drug until the late 1940s. Some people who went to sanatoria did get better, largely because they were no longer working 12-hour days and no longer eating terrible food and no longer sleeping in crowded conditions. If they had a sturdy immune system, the rest would allow some of them to get better. But virtually every family had someone with tuberculosis in it, and many of those people died. Sometimes it was a question of whether you would die sooner rather than later. If you were a young person and you had good care and you could afford to stop working for a while, the tuberculosis might be arrested and you might go some years without it coming back. Then it might come back later in your life during another time when you were sick or stressed with something else. So people really, really dreaded the diagnosis. They didn't think automatically, oh, I have tuberculosis, I'm going to die. But if you think about the way we respond now when we're given a diagnosis of some kind of cancer, if it's not one of the most immediately aggressive kinds, we are told by our doctors and we generally feel, oh, maybe I'm not going to die right now. But we also feel that a great shadow has entered our lives and that this is going to be something that we're going to be living with now for as long as we live. The feeling is maybe something like that for people who had tuberculosis then.
Let me take a detour in the next last couple minutes before the program is over and just ask you about your own life and your own history in coming to writing, because I think it offers a lot of hope, I think, to people who want to be writers, and you are a teacher now, teaching kids who you feel are so much further along at age 20 than you were at 30, which is really kind of an interesting thing. You moved around quite a bit as a kid, and you don't talk a lot about your background. You grew up in Cape Cod, and you've talked about how you didn't really form a lot of attachments with friends because you were always moving. But the area of Cape Cod was the landscape was what always stayed present, and that you read a great deal, but it never occurred to you to be a writer. And you said you never even met a writer until you were 30 years old.
Yeah, I just grew up ignorant, I guess. I really did love to read. I learned to read before I went to kindergarten. I always had a book in my hands. The most common phrase I can remember from my childhood is, "Would you put that down and go outside?" I always loved books. So how did I not make the leap to, oh, I will be a person who writes books? But I grew up in very little towns among people who didn't read much and certainly didn't write. I actually did not know that there was such a thing as a living writer somehow. For years and years, I thought writers were Tolstoy or George Eliot. They lived in France or in England or Russia. They were dead. They were mostly men. It really just was not part of my experience. I had a wonderful biology teacher in high school, so when I did eventually go to college and someone said, "What do you want to major in?" I thought, well, biology is wonderful. I love the ocean. I knew what Woods Hole was. I'd never seen it, but it was near where I grew up. And so that seemed to me to be a plausible adult life. And as I got older and I started writing in dabbling ways, I began to realize, oh, there are people who are called writers, and they're women, and they're alive. They don't actually make a living out of it, but they're living and they're writing. Maybe this is possible, and I, you know, began to feel a little more hopeful about it. I was a very slow starter, though, and I wrote for a long time without publishing anything. When Ship Fever did so well, everyone, you know, this is always the case, like, oh, she came out of nowhere, but In fact, that was my fifth book, and in fact, I had gone for 10 years writing very passionately before I published anything. I just took a long time to learn. So that does make me very hopeful as a teacher when I teach at conferences now, when I'm working with people who are in their 30s or 40s or 60s who have started writing late. I'm always apt to think anything is possible for them because I started late and I learned late, and it did work. It's not rocket science. A person can learn to do this. So.
Well, the other thing that I think is really interesting about your writing is the way you write and how incredibly constructed these books are. You talk about how it's not just a question of putting the word next to the word, but it's the sentence next to the sentence and how those paragraphs form. And so you've described it as like hideous. You said you're hideous, ugly, the way that it just takes forever. And I wonder if you had gone to writing programs, if it would have actually changed so much. What is so compelling about the way you write, maybe?
I don't know. My sense is that if I had gone to a writing program, I don't know if I would be different, but I think I would have learned a lot more quickly. What you learn on your own, teaching yourself to write, in the end is the same thing you learn at a good writing program, but it takes 10 years instead of 2 years. So there's a way in which you could say, oh, I lost a lot of time sort of teaching myself to write. But in another way, when you teach yourself to write, you do become very sure about what you want to write and what your characteristic material is, and you do develop your own odd set of working habits. And certainly that does influence the shape now of my narratives, of my paragraphs, of my sentences. I wish sometimes that I had not started writing so late, but I can't not like and not embrace now the way I learned to write, because it's the way I learned to write. It's the way I make my books now. It's also made me correspondingly unjudgmental about the way other writers make their books. People say, how should I write? Should I outline it first or should I just wander? And it's like, you know, whatever works for you is fine. There's a million ways to make a book. And the trick of becoming a writer is to find the way that you make a book, to find the set of circumstances and the way of approaching material that makes writing come out of you. It doesn't matter how you get there.
And what's your next? What are we going to see next?
I'm working on stories again. It's often typical for me after working for a long time on a novel to be writing stories. So I have two long stories in great chaos with little pieces hanging down, and I'm not sure what they are yet. But one of them actually does concern a character who walks off stage at the end of this book and who I once again thought I was done with but was not.
When you say off of this stage, do you mean stage from The Air We Breathe?
I do, yeah.
Oh, which one?
Eudora.
Eudora. We're going to see Eudora again.
Yeah.
I know it was difficult for you in a way to make that map at the end. You had resisted that. You had this thing that was sort of organically growing on your office. But it helps us. We can see the future and the past and establish some connections between Leo's kids and Miles's friends' kids and how that goes into the future. And it gives us a little view into your amazing mind.
Well, I'm actually glad to have published it. We talked about it for the last two books, but each time I felt, I'm not done. I don't want to print it. And it's not done now either. I'm still adding big wings to it. But at this point, it's not necessary to know the connections to read this book. But for people who have read the other books, there is, I guess, a kind of pleasure in being able to look at the connections. Although many people seem to have the experience the questioner had earlier of making their own map, which I think is wonderful. So for those of you who don't want to make your own map, there is a map pre-provided in the book.
Well, I can't thank you enough for being here, and I hope everybody will come back on November 11th for Ann Packer. But Andrea Barrett, thank you so much for joining us on Writers on the Record today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. On the next Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, Victoria's guest will be Ann Packer, author of Songs Without Words. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft and House Manager Chad Wachob. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunis is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Broadcasts of Writers on the Record are made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. You're tuned to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and to WFMT.com.